Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Standard Bank podcast. I'm your host, Ridi Tlhabi. So today we are asking a simple but powerful question. Why does infrastructure count? And what really counts as infrastructure? So across Africa, the conversation about roads, ports, and power grids often dominates headlines. But the real story is much bigger. Infrastructure is not just about concrete and steel. It's about people, opportunity, and the systems that connect our economies to life-saving services. So to explore this, I'm joined by two leaders shaping Africa's infrastructure investment landscape. Stephen Barnes, who's the head of Corporate and Investment Banking South Africa for Standard Bank. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you, Ridi. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. And we are also joined by Mohale Rakate, Chief Investment Officer for the Infrastructure Fund at the Development Bank of Southern Africa. Mohale, it's good to be with you.
Thanks very much. Also happy to be part of the podcast.
Thank you. And to our listeners, let me remind you that this podcast is a partnership between Standard Bank Group and Arena Holdings. So together, these institutions, DBSA and Standard Bank, have been at the forefront of mobilizing billions in infrastructure financing, from energy and water projects to data centers, transport, corridors, and even social infrastructure like housing and healthcare. So let's just frame the opportunity. I'm going to start with you, Stephen. When people hear the word infrastructure, they often picture roads or power lines. At least I do. I see a lot of building and construction. But the definition, from what I observe, has expanded. From your vantage point at Standard Bank, what counts as infrastructure in Africa today?
Yes, really. I mean, it's an extremely broad concept, infrastructure. You know, it is, I think, as you introduced the topic, the systems that really underpin the functioning of any economy. So it does range from, you know, the hard productive infrastructure that you described, the energy assets, the road infrastructure, the rail, et cetera, that underpin a lot of the economic activity. But it also is the systems and the people and the governance that actually support the functioning of an economy. So it's incredibly broad. And then to the point, it also extends all the way into, you know, the social side of the economy. It's the provision of social infrastructure like schools, hospitals, et cetera, which, again, allow for the appropriate functioning of any society and economy. So very broad.
Sure. And Mohale, from you, what would you add to that? What constitutes infrastructure, especially from the priorities of the DBSA? What do you look at and say this fulfills our infrastructure development mandate?
Yeah, I think Steve has really covered the sectors that we focus on, you know, as a development finance institution, and in particular as the Infrastructure Fund, which is really a blended finance platform created through a partnership between DBSA, National Treasury, and Infrastructure South Africa, the latter being attached to the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure. So our mandate since 2020, when we were established, was really to look at how we enable private sector to participate more and more in the development of infrastructure. And in our definition, we look at economic infrastructure, which would be your network industries like rail, roads, ports, also water sector, ICT, and energy. But on the social side, we look at, as Steve said, education and housing and health. And broadly, you know, we say infrastructure in that sense. And from our perspective, the two subsectors of infrastructure are equally important. On the economic side is around economic development, jobs, creating opportunities for trade and movement of goods, whereas on the social side, it's human development essentially, which will feed into economic infrastructure in a way. So we see our role really as enabling infrastructure through what we do to really power the economy. And one of the key objectives, as I said, is to anchor, you know, more participation by private sector into economic infrastructure. And specifically, we do that by preparing projects, you know, de-risking them using government money. And then we go out to the private sector to come in and participate.
I always do this when I'm speaking to a South African audience, to say we need to think broadly. We're not talking about infrastructure development for Sandton, Soweto, Pretoria, Gauteng, whatever. We are part of a thriving and competitive continent, and the stability of our infrastructure architecture has huge benefits for the African continent. I want to hear more about the work that you are doing, that your organizations are doing, the projects that you are doing. I know you have a presence in Kenya, Nigeria, Mozambique, South Africa. Stephen, can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, with pleasure. So look, firstly, you know, infrastructure is a critical underpin to any economy, and we have a physical presence in 21 markets across Africa. Now, it's critical to get the infrastructure in these jurisdictions right in order to ensure that we have prosperity from a general economic perspective. You know, if you look at the stats really as a starting point, each rand of infrastructure, productive infrastructure that's spent typically tends to land up with, you know, 1.5 to 3 rands worth of benefit in the broader economy. And so that's a critical data point. It's not just return on the actual, you know, infrastructure build per se, but it's also the impact that it has on your broader economic activity and output. And I think this is critical. And then, you know, we typically as a commercial bank tend to focus on those elements of infrastructure which are commercially bankable, meaning that we can generate some kind of return for our stakeholders. But the benefits of putting in productive infrastructure actually, as I've suggested, extend to the broader economy. And so, you know, when we invest in road, rail, or ports, for example, or digital infrastructure, there's a spin-off into the broader economy. So if we use digital infrastructure as a good example, you know, if we finance fiber, or if we finance the rollout of a tower network, which happens to then extend into rural areas, that benefits the communities which are living and operating in those areas. So if you think about digital, you know, for the SMEs, it means that they now can, you know, market online their businesses, that they can access payment systems which they haven't necessarily before, that they can access data around their business, they can, you know, access learning material and so on. And so there's a real multiplier effect here when we get this productive infrastructure right. So as a bank, we're obviously typically focused around those network industries that Mahale described earlier. And so if you know, asked us what our focus is, it's probably more around energy, transportation, water, and digital infrastructure. A lot of the social infrastructure is actually really difficult to finance from our perspective, even if we would like to, and typically it lands up being the mandate of some of the development financing institutions and government, because it more fits their mandates. So we're very active across the whole infrastructure spectrum, but as I say, it typically tends to focus on those items which are commercially bankable for us. In other words, they produce cash flows which we can finance against.
Yeah. And of course, the Development Bank of Southern Africa, you do also have a regional mandate. You've supported project preparation and infrastructure work in the SADC region. There's climate finance facility that I read about. Talk to us about your regional presence.
Yeah, indeed. DBSA's mandate actually spans across, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, you know, the SADC region, even up to Ghana, you know, Sierra Leone and the Ivory Coast on the west, and then on the east, Kenya and Tanzania, Ethiopia. So really we are a Pan-African development finance institution, and, you know, really focusing again, as I said, on the various sectors of the infrastructure landscape. And if you look at the value chain, it's from project prep, financing, and even building, you know, in cases where you have counterparties who are not able to do these things on their own. So we provide that capacity support to even build. But, you know, specifically about my role as the infrastructure fund, because we are really ring-fenced from the DBSA with a role to prepare projects on behalf of the South African government through National Treasury fiscal allocations. And I'll give you a few examples as the conversation proceed. We are then able to, you know, take projects that, you know, historically could not be banked and de-risk them, to the extent that the likes of Standard Bank can participate. In fact, there's one project that Standard Bank is looking at. I understand you got credit approvals recently, the Olifants Model Management Program. It's a water project in Limpopo, in Burgersfort, towards the area. It's meant to enable platinum mines to produce, as you know, lots of water is needed in the process. But at the same time, you need to service communities around. So there's a Duhop Dam, which is full with water, mm-hmm. but no pipelines to support the water provision to the mines, and lots of mines, up to 20 of them. They formed a consortium called an association so that they can package this project with our support. So to cut a long story short, what we did in this 8.5 billion project, we modeled it and came to a determination that we need around 3 billion from government to enable the adjacent communities to also access water. And on the back of offtakes from the mines, we are raising around 5 billion, which Standard Bank from your area, Steve, mm-hmm. is contributing towards that. So that's really our role. So we get measured by how much we enable infrastructure to happen, so that we can reach the desired 30% fixed capital formation that we envisage in the National Development Plan. And I have a few examples that I'll share as we move along. So our role really is to package these projects early, the critical projects that would move the needle for the country, package them in such a way that we farm them out to be funded by, DFIs like DBSA, and also, commercial investment banks that we have in the country and beyond.
Okay.
Yeah, this is actually, if I might come in there, this is such a critical point, right? Mm. So, I think the stats around Africa's infrastructure, Mohale, are very well publicized around the requirement, which is around about $175 billion annually, and what we're actually able to finance at the moment, which is half of that effectively, And so we have to crowd in all forms of capital. Mm. And the development financial institutions have a fundamental role to play in that regard. And we rely heavily on our partnership with you and other DFIs in order to bring these infrastructure projects to fruition. Because very often, to your point, there's risk which suits your risk appetite and mandate, and then the more commercial risk which suits ours. And without the two of us sort of coming together, we can't bring these projects to life. So these kind of partnerships between the DFIs and commercial banks are critical, and their other stakeholders in there, which we rely on too. So, yeah, we really are in that realm across the continent where we need to crowd in as much capital as we possibly can.
Yeah, it's so interesting you said that. I was just thinking about it, that, Mohale, for you, DBSA is known for financing projects that don't just drive growth but improve lives. I know Standard Bank does the same, but there are always those risks. I wanted to talk about, when we talk about why infrastructure counts, how do you balance economic returns with social impact? You've spoken to that a little, Stephen, but I'd like to hear it from DBSA's side. Something is important. It has economic returns, but sometimes those returns are not obvious. They're not immediate, but there is a social impact, especially in a continent such as ours that is really debilitated by inequality.
Yeah, I think you are on point, Reddy. I mean, really, the starting point when we look at these infrastructure opportunities across the board, we start off, obviously, with the impact that potentially this infrastructure would make. It's very key, and we look at it from perspective of access. If you look at social infrastructure, it's around health access, educational opportunities. You look at water, it's still real that people share water with animals in some parts of South Africa. So we look at it from that perspective. It's very key. Equally important is financial sustainability. So those are really mutually inclusive from our perspective. But of course, our stakeholders, government, the people that we meant to service, are looking at impact, and DFIs are really about impact, not to the detriment of financial sustainability. Because the last thing you want is also to go back to government requesting a bailout when you're reaching your impact objectives. It must be that you are sustainable financially, but you really extend the footprint of your impact. And you do this by really crowding in other role players in the ecosystem, like your other DFIs, we work very closely with them, even international. 2.5 weeks ago, we got the Dutch government to support us with a 500 million grant to support a waste-to-energy project here in Johannesburg. We had a signing ceremony. So we're able to go even beyond, you know, the realms of our geography to get all the support we can. And from our perspective, we see collaboration rather than competition, you know, in the space. And as Steve said, we really define our role in terms of what are the risks that are there in projects, and we really see ourselves as playing a critical role in addressing those risks. And we measure our success when, you know, more players come in and play rather than us crowding them out. Yeah, so coming back to your question, impact is really very important. And in fact, is at the cutting edge of what we do.
Stephen, you know, I'm just sitting here thinking, you know, Africa's infrastructure investment is not charity. It's smart business. But we also have this continent that has the world's fastest growing urban populations and consumer markets. I'm closing my eyes thinking of where I come from. I was born in Soweto. I've lived in Johannesburg all my life. And then you see the needs in our society and you see how they can be solved by innovation, by skills, even before you get to access to financing. I wonder how you would assess our ability as a country, even as a continent, to identify opportunities and turn what we often talk about as a burden, whether it's unemployment, youth unemployment, to turn these into opportunities. Are we doing enough to identify where the opportunities lie? I guess where I'm going here is a report that I read about Africa's infrastructure gap, that it is massive. The African Development Bank estimated that the continent needs about 130 million, a billion to 170 billion every year in infrastructure investment, with a financing gap that is also in those billions. So I'm just thinking, where do we see the biggest opportunities and what are those kind of interventions that we can make quickly, but with sustainability in our minds?
Yeah, it's a great question, really. And I'll just go back to the first point that you made. I mean, Africa's got a very, very significant demographic dividend. We're the fastest growing continent from a population perspective. And, you know, if you look at the African population, 25 and under makes up 60% of the total population. And so, you know, that's expected to add roughly 600 to 700 million people to the workforce by 2050. And so that demographic dividend actually creates a very, very significant economic opportunity in terms of people coming into the labor force, the consumption that it brings, particularly given the fact it's a young demographic. They typically tend to be more digitally savvy. And so you get that ability to, you know, kind of have the you know, leap from a digital perspective. So, you know, this dividend is a massive blessing on the one hand, yet on the other hand, it obviously puts a lot of strain on the systems, particularly infrastructure. So you have rapid urbanization, for example, which is putting strain on infrastructure across the continent. And as a consequence, we're seeing all these gaps that you spoke about and I referenced earlier. There's a huge amount to be done and probably not enough financing to do it at the moment. And so, you know, when you talk about opportunity, it is vast. If you just think about it from a financing gap perspective, we're talking $100 billion potentially annually at the top end that remains to be financed outside of what's already being done. And, you know, it goes back to the point that I was making up front, that so much of getting infrastructure right is about ultimately a social dividend as well. Because if we can produce the road, the rail, the electricity access, clean water, sanitation, et cetera, that creates foundations on which economies can be properly built. And so, you know, society benefits from that. So I'm very clear in my own head that there's no shortage of opportunity. In fact, there's opportunity at every turn. And really what it is for us, I would argue, Mahali, is really trying to find ways to make more of these opportunities bankable. So how do we attract the financing, which will always be a combination of government, you know, development financial institutions, commercial banks, institutional asset managers, and others, to make it happen? But how do we really build more bankable projects or produce more bankable projects so that we can close that gap quicker? Because if we do that, we'll see that multiplier effect come to the fore, and that'll be significantly positive for Africa's economic growth and prosperity.
Mohale, please can you speak to that, the opportunity bit? And just again, I mean, it's so easy to identify a problem and imagine how the problem can be solved. But then this, the challenge of accessing finance and creating a project that is bankable. Just share your thoughts on the same issues.
Yeah. In my view, I don't think we have an issue of, you know, financing as such, you know, pots and pots of capital, you know, looking for investment opportunities. And what makes me, you know, happy, I've been in the sector for close to 20 years now, if not more. For the first time, I mean, in the last, say, 5 years, I've seen governments, and in particular, you know, our government in South Africa, really focusing on infrastructure as a sector that, if unlocked, could enable opportunities to happen in the economic sectors, and then thus creating opportunities for employment and development. And you can look at various sectors. I mean, starting, of course, with the, you know, the REAP program around renewable energy. That has been really a demonstrable program that shows that if you create an enabling environment, you'll be able to attract private sector into the economy. That program was started by DBSA, National Treasury, and Department of Energy then in 2010, still running. And on the back of that program, you have the transmission program coming through. You would have seen Steve, the Minister of Transport, you know, coming up with clear intent to work on you know, bringing private sector in the transport sector, you know, the rail and ports and so on, and real commitment where specific capacities are established, you know, through partnerships to drive that initiative of bringing in more players in the form of financiers and also implementers, because government doesn't have all the capacity to implement. So the environment for me is ripe, and I see, you know, lots of appetite from government to do that. It's more around implementation. You know, if you address the transmission, all of a sudden you have stable access. Generation is no longer a big issue now. You know, it was a big issue some years ago. It's being resolved, and going forward it will be resolved. We have an issue on the transmission. So you resolve that by bringing private sector. Then you're bringing in economic enablers, you know, the transport sector equally. We're working very closely with Transnet as the infrastructure fund to support them in such a way that they are able again to get private sector to come in. You'll hear in the next few months some of the initiatives that we have been working with them on. Some of them could be approved by government with the, you know, funds being put through to again anchor the possibility of private sector participation. So that's what we need across the continent and even in more sectors in South Africa, so that we create an enabling environment that will enable private sector to come in. And our sense is that for projects that we have been able to de-risk, there's oversubscription from financiers when we go out to invite them to come and play. So more and more, and that's the message that we engage with government on, to say we need to build more capacity around project preparation, but also looking at the regulations so that you remove the red tape that is there. You know, you have Operation Vulindlela, you know, in National Treasury and the Presidency. They are forever looking at various initiatives. The latest one is around the metro trading services, so that you ring fence revenues from electricity and water. And in that way, you begin to make, you know, municipalities more bankable with regards to those ring-fenced services. So you form SPVs, you know, sort of within metros. And on the back of the revenues now that are ring-fenced rather than being used for general use by municipalities, you are able to then, you know, bring financiers to the table, because they have a see-through of the revenues, which are, you know, locked in into specific ring-fenced accounts. Yeah, so for me, the most important thing is for governments to continue to be encouraged and be supported, be capacitated to really enable projects to be de-risked.
I mean, I do want to we can be diplomatic. Yes, that's good. Yep. But, you know, one pays attention to your Auditor General report, especially on municipalities. And I'm thinking I'm developing gray hairs now talking about the same things when I started off as a journalist about the municipalities that are just not rising to the occasion, that are not mindful or being capacitated to be hubs of economic activity. The corruption that is there, we are all glued to this Madlanga Commission, and it is global. I'm talking to you. I'm sitting in Washington. People ask me all the time, what on earth is happening? What did the health department do? They want to know. And you can't really talk mobilizing capital and mitigating risk without addressing investor relations, the governance issues, transparency, even local participation. Those are all the issues that I think about as I pay attention to these very disturbing trends, that how do communities participate in economic activity when there are these governance failures? Where's the transparency? Where's the governance? What do you say to investors? How do you mobilize capital in this context? So I wonder if anyone is comfortable just going there, talking about that, or perhaps if not talking specifically about these case studies that I've mentioned, how in the concessional capital and the funding models that you put on the table, how much emphasis do you put on governance and transparency? What do you want to see on that side?
Yeah. If I can come in, you are on point again. And you'll be surprised to know that even though we are government owned, we still place lots of importance on governance itself around the partners that we work with. And the challenges are well recorded. One can't papa the cracks and say they aren't there. And the approach that we are taking is really to look within the ecosystem, those partners that we can work with there. You know, we call it the willing coalition approach. You do have pockets and more of partners that you can work with. You demonstrate that if you work with them well, you know, infrastructure can be well delivered, taking account of transparency, cost effectiveness, and so on. So it's a serious problem that is presented, and we just need to really demonstrate where, you know, you have willing partners who are ready to subject themselves to strong governance processes. Because our role as the infrastructure fund is not only to solution, you know, the financing elements, but to also ensure that procurement is done properly. Maintenance over the life of the project is also done in a sustainable manner. You don't have projects that are implemented today and tomorrow they are white elephants. You know, we put all those systems in place. And our experience is that at the national level and SOC level, we are seeing serious improvements. And I've just spoken about the metro side where, you know, National Treasury is really intervening, you know, on the basis of a carrot approach, where if you comply with specific governance protocols around how you manage your infrastructure, you get rewarded with some substantial grant funding to even implement better. I hope that approach, you know, done at the metro level successfully, could be replicated to the rest of the municipal sector. Because as you correctly say, that's where the biggest challenge lies, and that is the cold face of delivery. And if you have your local government not working well, you are really challenged. But another piece to share is that, you know, in the context of DBSA, you know, investing in the municipal sector, they are able to also put serious governance protocols such that if you look at DBSA's results, the non-performing loans are really very low. So that can be done through partnerships to ensure that you work with those partners that are willing to subject themselves to strict governance principles. And when their neighbors see that progress is being made, it's likely to get them to change. But also, you know, national government really playing a role, like I said, with the metro trading reforms, really replicating that across the board. You're likely to see more changes. But yeah, the approach really from our perspective is to work with those who want to work with you and make a difference and hope that you impact on the system with your examples that work. Like I said, the RIP was implemented 12 years ago, and then now you have various formats of RIP, you know, in various sectors. based on its globally accepted success.
And Stephen, you want to talk about this?
Yeah, I'd love to just jump in there quickly. I mean, I think you've articulated it incredibly well, Marlies. I don't have a lot to add there, but, just to conclude by saying that we have to get service delivery right at the municipal level. It's an absolutely critical outcome in South Africa. So there's an incredible amount of work that's required to get there. But at a more macro level, really, I would also just say that we've done quite a lot of research as a bank on governance and transparency, and actually it's the number one determinant of long-term economic prosperity. So, if you go and benchmark countries against governance over time, you'll see that the countries that are most prosperous have managed to get their governance and right over long periods of time. So, we need strong legislative backdrop. Regulations are critical. We need to address crime and corruption. We have to have a strong judiciary. These are the pillars, really, or the foundations of economic success. And we don't get those right. Unfortunately, I don't think we will prosper over the long term. So this is a critical thing to address.
Yeah. I want to get your final thoughts on, just the way forward, unlocking trade. We are in a very uncertain geopolitical moment. It's well known the tensions between South Africa and the United States, also affecting the region as well, because, as I said, we are the economic hub of the continent. The reciprocal tariffs that they call them here in the United States affecting various countries, others far more than others. So it is kind of a very uncertain time. It's a very fragile moment in the geopolitical space. If first world countries are also struggling with their economies, how much more us on the tip of Africa? So I just want to get your reflections on Africa's future. I mean, those who are positive will say Africa's opportunities far outweigh its challenges. We have global platforms such as the G20, B20. We have been reading and talking about the African Continental Free Trade Area. What is it pioneering? What will it unlock? What does the future look like from your point of view as we conclude?
Yeah, so I think it is volatile times at the moment, really, and there's a huge amount of uncertainty globally, actually, at the moment around trade and tariffs. And so you are seeing a rebalancing, an early stage of shifting or trade shifting globally. But I think it's changing every day. And as I said, the market's incredibly fluid. So I don't necessarily think that people are making long-term decisions at the moment, but making tactical decisions to, address trade at the moment. And so you are seeing some shifts. So firstly, I think we're working hard to try and address the reciprocal tariffs that have been put on us by the US. And so that's very positive. And so hopefully that will bear fruit. But at the same time, we're obviously also looking at where else we can direct trade flows. And one of the interesting developments we're seeing as a bank is trade flow out of the Middle East. Mm. And we've recently opened a rep office in Egypt, which will partly allow us to facilitate trade flow between the Middle East and the East more generally and Africa. And then, you spoke about it earlier, which is the African Continental Free Trade Area. I think we've got 48 states that have ratified that agreement to date. It does offer, I think, very significant uplift to the African collective economy, which, is around $3 trillion. I think you could pencil in $400 to $500 billion uplift to that number by 2030 if you can get the integration right from an African continental free trade area perspective. So I think integration is important for Africa. I think it does offer us a lot of upside. And so no doubt is something that the continent needs to focus on as a collective, particularly as we reorient some of the historic trade flows, at the current time.
Mohale, final thoughts on that?
I agree with Steve. And maybe from our perspective as a fund and also in the DFI space, is really to, again, on infrastructure, create the necessary infrastructure to enable, diversification, penetrating new markets, and ensuring that you mitigate, the risks around tariffs. Again, I've seen articles that say, our trade with the U.S., it's painful that it's being impacted, but it's not a big percentage, so you can, you can diversify, obviously you need some time to do that, some investments to do that. but it's not a train smash.
Yeah, and just sorry, one final point for me. I mean, I think this concept of regional integration can't be underestimated, right? So think about it from a power pool perspective and how much more efficient you can be when you integrate regional generation. The same applies to rail and thinking about corridors as opposed to rail lines. You know, that's when I think the real magic happens.
Oh, I've really loved chatting to you, Muhaile and Stephen, and just hearing practical voice, a commitment to building Africa, reminding us of why infrastructure counts, that it is at the forefront of our economic development, but also the social impact. I've loved chatting to you. Thank you both for giving us your time on the Standard Bank podcast.
Thank you so much, Rudy.
Thank you, Rudy.
Thanks, Muhaile.
Thanks.
Thank you. That was Stephen Barnes, Head of Corporate and Investment Banking South Africa for Standard Bank Group, and also Muhaile Rakgate, Chief Investment Officer for the Infrastructure Fund at the Development Bank of Southern Africa.